and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight. I'm Nick Blumberg. Brandis Friedman is on assignment. Here's what we're looking at.
And if we dare to struggle, we dare to win.
In one of her first sit-down interviews, we talk with congressional candidate Patty Garcia on her vision for the office and how she hopes to win over voters.
Education is local. It should be overseen locally.
The Trump administration is dismantling the Department of Education, what the restructuring plan could mean.
Being a Latino pharmacist coming out, I felt like I had to prove myself. The pressure was there.
And meet a local pharmacist working to bridge gaps in his community. First off tonight, the release of hundreds of Operation Midway Blitz detainees is on hold for the time being. As many as 615 people were in line for release after a federal judge found federal immigration agents repeatedly violated a consent decree restricting warrantless arrests in Illinois. Court records show fewer than 3% of those detainees have a criminal record, but earlier today, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals put their release on hold. A hearing on the issue is scheduled on December 2nd. Federal prosecutors are dropping charges against a woman shot by a Border Patrol agent. Marimar Martinez had faced claims she assaulted federal agents in Brighton Park last month. Prosecutors had claimed that Martinez and a second defendant, Anthony Ian Santos Ruiz, rammed a Border Patrol vehicle as neighbors were tracking immigration enforcement efforts and that she was shot after boxing agents in. But subsequent texts showed the agent bragging about shooting Martinez, saying he'd, quote, fired 5 rounds and she had 7 holes. Put that in your book, boys. In a brief motion today, prosecutors moved to dismiss the indictment against Martinez and Ruiz. At an afternoon hearing, attorneys confirmed the dismissal with prejudice, meaning charges can't be refiled, but provided no explanation. As Chicago's city council continues its heated budget debate, Cook County commissioners unanimously sign off on a 2026 spending plan. Board President Tony Preckwinkle says the $10 billion county budget is aimed at making up for federal cuts in funding on health, public safety, and other issues. The budget doesn't include any tax hikes or service cuts, and it makes permanent a pilot guaranteed income program, that was initially funded by federal COVID relief money. The group Economic Security Illinois says that makes Cook County the first government body in the U.S. with a permanent income program. Up next, one-on-one with candidate for Congress Patty Garcia. She joins us in studio right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
Congressman Chuy Garcia surprised constituents and political watchers earlier this month with a last-minute announcement he wouldn't seek re-election. That announcement came paired with the revelation that just one other candidate had gathered signatures to get on the Democratic primary ballot, his chief of staff, Patty Garcia, no relation. Chuy Garcia's move was blasted as Chicago machine politics, earning him a rebuke from his colleagues in the House of Representatives. But in launching her campaign last week, Patty Garcia said there were no electoral shenanigans and vowed to protect immigrant and working class communities. And joining us now is the congressional candidate herself, Patty Garcia. Thanks for being on the program.
Thank you for the invite.
So you've worked in politics and policy for quite some time, but you're not necessarily a widely known quantity. Tell us a bit about yourself briefly.
So I was born and raised in Chicago in Little Village. Both of my parents are immigrants from Mexico. I grew up in a union home, and I am a proud graduate of Chicago Public Schools and also from the U of I. I earned my education policy doctorate degree from the U of I. And education for me has always been a passion. It's what's led me to do civic education, voter engagement, building the next generation of leaders, including training people to run for office, as well as then training elected officials to be effective in their roles. And so most recently, doing government work, and this is where I've learned a great deal working with Congressman Chuy Garcia for the last 7 years, first as district director for 4 years, and the last almost 3 years as chief of staff. And so everything from, you know, how to advance a progressive agenda and ensure that we're delivering for our communities, to how to secure grants grants, right, from flood mitigation to youth centers to hospitals, as well as casework, right? And especially right now when we're seeing the Trump attacks and the dismantling of federal agencies, we need to ensure that we're protecting constituents, that we're getting them out of detention centers, that we're giving them the resources that they need to ensure that they have safe homes and safe communities.
Yeah. So as we mentioned, the congressman announced he was leaving the race shortly before the filing deadline. Should he have said publicly what he told you privately, that he couldn't make another run so other candidates could have had at least a few days to gather signatures?
Look, there was a lot going on. I'm sure you all know that Little Village has been an area in the 4th District has been a target by the Trump administration for enforcement. And so from that Friday through that Monday, it was just, I keep using the word whirlwind. It was a whirlwind. It was a roller coaster of one, emotions, but also now we need to get on the ballot, right? And so that was the priority, to ensure that we could get on the ballot. We had less than 2 days, essentially, to be able to collect the minimum, which in the 4th District is about 700. I'm proud to say that we were able to collect over twice that amount that is required, and we had over 75 volunteers helping us ensure that we got on the ballot. So it was a lot to do in a short amount of time, and I'm happy that I had the support of community members and of voters from across the district to get on the ballot.
But I mean, how do you respond to folks who say it's sort of a classic machine politics play here, that it might tarnish the congressman's legacy?
Look, anyone could have filed at any point. And we've said that consistently. I've said that consistently, that we didn't stop anyone from gathering their petitions. We didn't stop anyone from filing. The Board of Elections are open, as it is to anybody else. The process is open to anybody else. Anyone who's interested can file at any point. And there are two other candidates on the ballot. This isn't a done deal, right? I'm taking this seriously, and I'm going out to every voter, to every municipality, to every neighborhood and ward. There are still an election to run. There are still two other candidates who are also filed to run. And as I've said, it was an opportunity for anyone else to run. And I just want to make sure that I add that I've been with the congressman since 2019, and every single election, people have filed to run. So we assumed other people would be filing to run as well.
Sure, although it is a fairly safe Democratic district, so had folks, you know, had more of a heads up, there may have been, you know, a wave of people, mm-hmm. as we've seen in some mm-hmm. of the districts where folks are retiring.
Yeah, and he had a primary last cycle, and, you know, we had to adjust for that and make sure that we had the voters knew about the congressman and why he was a better choice. And so, you know, now for me, I'm focused on my race and ensuring that people know who I am, that we get back to the issues and ensure that people know why I'm the better option and why I've been doing this work and why I'm the right person to continue their work.
Yeah, as you said, it was sort of a whirlwind for Amy. Yeah. I mean, when did the congressman tell you his decision and become the first signature on your petition?
It wasn't until Friday where we final kind of a decision there, and we didn't start circulating till Saturday. But yes, it was literally less than 24 hours from when a final decision was made and when we had to get and work on a petition and get out to the doors and recruit people to come out.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we mm-hmm. mentioned, you know, earlier this week, the House did vote to censure yeah. Congressman Garcia. That included 23 Democrats, two of whom are from the Illinois delegation. Are you confident you can repair those relationships should you be elected, especially within, you know, your own potential caucus?
Look, the reality is that right now Democrats need to be united. There are other more important issues that matter. I've been hearing from, as I was knocking on doors collecting signatures, as I've been working with people across the district, people care about, can I get food on the table? Can I pay the rent? Can I put my child through childcare, right? Like, those are the real issues that matter to voters, not the insider kind of drama between one member or another member, or the political targeting that might happen, or the personal kind of attacks against one another. Those are the things that actually people don't want. Voters don't want to see, you know, that disconnected kind of work. They want members there who are delivering for them. And so I'm confident that with the relationships that I've already built with some of these members as a chief of staff, that I can earn their support.
Well, and to some of those issues, you've talked a lot, you know, about protecting immigrant communities, many of whom call the 4th District home. Yeah. What would your priorities be in that arena should you be elected?
Look, it's been over 40 years since we've had any meaningful immigration reform. So number one for me is, of course, immigration. As a daughter of immigrants, as someone who's had to go fight ICE and go to Broadview and go do surprise visit at detention centers, I've seen the atrocities of this immigration system, and it's not just one president. It's been a system that has completely vilified and criminalized immigrants and separated families, and I think that it's important to prioritize a pathway to citizenship. It's unfair that people have been here 20, 30 years contributing to our economy, helping, you know, raise our doctors, our teachers, and yet they can't even get protection that they won't be deported, right? And so for one, number one priority, immigration, ensuring that we have a pathway to citizenship, ensuring that we protect our DACA recipients. It's time, right? They've been here, and it's time to give them some real protection and long-term protection. We've got temporary protective status for people that we need to work on, as well as some work permits. There's people here that at minimum they want protection and work permits. And so that's my number one priority, immigration, especially given the demographics of the district. There are people here that have been waiting 20, 30 years, as I've said, to become citizens. And so that's number one. With my background in education, that's another, you know, again, passion of mine. I want to make sure that we have good paying jobs, that we have better workforce partnerships with institutions and higher ed, and that from birth to college, kids have affordable and quality education, regardless of where they've grown up or, you know, what's their background.
You know, we just exited the longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history with a handful of Democrats, mm-hmm. including Senator Dick Durbin, voting to reopen. Would you have cast a vote to reopen?
I think we should have walked away until we had something to walk away with, right? We should have waited to ensure that we had at minimum some health care. And I would have worked with community members and with our stakeholders to hear from them directly. I know that a lot of the organizations said, Democrats, we've got your back. Hold the line a little longer. We haven't come this long to then give and walk away with nothing.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, you've been working with the congressman since 2019, yeah. including most recently as his chief of staff. What accomplishment from that tenure are you most proud of?
I think the most proud of, I'll say two.
All right,
I'll make it quick. On the casework side, there's nothing more rewarding than being able to reunite families and get someone out of detention. And so I've got amazing stories of people that I've been able to help release, fathers on Father's Day, mothers on Mother's Day. And, like, you know, I think about my parents. I think about my neighbors, right? And, like, I wouldn't want someone to fight as hard like that, like the way that I have for others. So I think that that to me has been the most rewarding experience, being able to fight and defend for others, and also bringing back resources to the district. So the community project funding, being able to identify what, you know, youth centers, hospitals, healthcare centers, flood mitigation programs, all these things that are tangible. It's not these abstract kind of federal funds that you don't see. You get to work with the community to identify what would you like to see in your area, right? And so those are some of my favorite kind of projects.
All right, 4th District mm-hmm. candidate Patty Garcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, the Trump administration moves to dismantle the Education Department. What that might look like right after this. Department of Education is shrinking. Many of the offices that carry out its key functions are set to shift to other federal agencies. It's the latest step in President Donald Trump's push to make good on his campaign pledge to dismantle the department entirely. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said this morning the changes will address, quote, our own bureaucratic bloat.
We have linked 6 groundbreaking partnerships with other federal agencies to delegate Education Department programs that are redundant with existing programs at Labor, State, Interior, and HHS. These interagency agreements to cut our own bureaucratic bloat are a key step in our efforts to shift educational authority from Washington, D.C. to your state education agency.
And McMahon also called on Congress to make these new changes permanent. Joining us to discuss everything that's happening is Kirabo Jackson, a professor of education and social policy at Northwestern University and former appointee to the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Professor Jackson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this overhaul is set to shift funding for schools serving low-income communities to the Department of Labor. Grants for parents attending colleges will go to Health and Human Services. Foreign language funding over to state and Native American education programs to Interior. Are these other agencies built to effectively administer those programs?
No, they're not. So, you know, the Department of Education serves a lot of different functions. And, you know, I just want to make clear from a historical perspective, you know, the Department of Education was established in 1979. Before then, it was Health, Education, and Welfare. And there was an acknowledgement that a lot of the things that were happening to serve students in this country should have been housed within one central department that really took care of all those different aspects. So, you know, when you think about administering the Title I program, which really provides funds for low-income children in this country, in Chicago, I think about 90% of schools are Title I schools, so we're heavily dependent on that money. That is not something that the Department of Labor is really equipped to do. So I'm a little concerned about that. I would also say that, you know, I wonder to what extent this represents sort of a shifting of orientation away from education being something that is designed to promote overall human thriving towards thinking in a much narrower view about education as only towards serving to make sure people have skills to serve the labor market right now. I think obviously that's part of what education is there to do, but it's not everything.
You know, and the department announced these new interagency agreements on Tuesday. There's not a clear timeline of when they go into place. I mean, are you concerned about the speed at which things are moving? Could this create delays in funding or other snags?
It absolutely could. So in principle, what you'd like to see is that personnel who are currently involved in the Department of Education, we're going to take advantage of the institutional knowledge, decades of institutional knowledge that people have acquired over the course of years working at the Department of Education. I would like to see if they were going to make this move in a way that was sort of responsible, that those individuals would move over to the other entities, move over to HHS, to move over to labor. But I don't see any indication of that. What seems to be happening is that we're going to move over the functions and leave people where they are, which I think could absolutely have deleterious effects for the people who depend on these funds. And I just want to be clear, a lot of the money that the federal government spends in education goes towards the more fragile members of our society, low-income kids, people who need access to money to go to college, and these are the individuals who are going to suffer.
You mentioned CPS. You're right, 89% of schools qualify for that Title I funding. What sort of an effect could this have on kids here in Chicago?
That's a really great question. So it's important to put all this into context. So overall, in terms of how much money comes from the federal government that goes to public schools, nationally, it's about 10% of the budget comes from the federal government. In Chicago, that number is probably a little bit higher, closer to, say, 20%. So when we're talking about that amount of money, it's not the lion's share. Most of the control and the money really still is at the local and the state level. But losing a fifth of your budget absolutely can have deleterious effects. So to put that into perspective, you're talking about losing maybe $2,000 per kid. Estimates show that would reduce college-going rates by about 6 or 7%. So that's a really meaningful impact we could see if we were to sort of have that money go away.
So we mentioned that sort of the accusations of bloat at the top of the segment. Trump administration says the Education Department is too big, about 4,200 employees, 17 offices, a nearly $200 billion budget in 2025. What do you make of that argument? Is there too much bureaucracy there at Ed? Is it bloated?
I wouldn't say that it's bloated. Let me just be clear. You know, whether something is bloated or not really has to be a comparison of size relative to function. The Department of Education does a lot of things. It has a lot of different functions. I've mentioned a few already, administering, say, the Pell Grant program to make sure people have access to financial aid, making sure the student loan programs are properly administered, making sure the Office of Civil Rights is there to enforce laws that require that students are not being discriminated against. There's a lot of actions that are happening within the Department of Education, some of which is also research, collecting data, making sure we understand where things are, setting rules and standards for schools in a variety of domains. So that requires a lot of different moving parts, and it requires a reasonable size bureaucracy. So to say that just because there are a lot of people employed by the department that is bloated, I don't think is quite the way to look at it. You have to look at the size of the department relative to all the functions that is actually being carried out by the department.
You know, the administration says breaking up the education department will put more power in the hands of states, of school districts, of parents. What do you make of that argument?
So I don't think that makes any sense. So right now, what is being proposed or what is being spoken about right now is essentially moving control or moving some of the functions from one federal part of the branch of the government to another within the federal government. So we're talking about moving from education to labor or to HHS. These are all still within the federal government. So nothing that is being discussed here is moving any power down towards the states or to local entities. So that doesn't make any sense. Mm. I would also just want to say very clearly that a lot of this conversation is predicated on this idea that somehow the federal government is controlling what is happening in schools. That is just not the case. Most of the day-to-day decisions that are happening within schools are determined by in the local level and at the state level. It is true that the federal government does provide some resources to help students who are in need, who are from low-income backgrounds, but most of the day-to-day decisions are really not happening at the federal level. So the entire predicate of this argument doesn't really hold water.
And do you think that's part of why, you know, President Trump, some politicians, some voters want to see the department dismantled, this idea that it's somehow, you know, a complete federal control of what happens in classrooms each day?
So I think there are two things potentially going on. I think one is I think there's somewhat of a misconception in the among the public that somehow the federal government is responsible for the curriculum that is being taught. Some people have called it woke or whatever you want to use. That terminology has been used to describe what is happening in schools, and people associate that with things that are happening from the federal government. But that is not what the federal government really is involved in. The federal government has guidelines, say, to enforce civil rights. So, for example, we have laws that say that you cannot have have exclusionary discipline policies that disproportionately impact African American boys, for example. Those are the kinds of things that would be enforced by the civil rights arm of the Department of Education. That's not woke, that's just maintaining laws. But I think there's been a confounding of those ideas, and the thinking is, well, if the federal government is enforcing laws and making sure that you know, certain rules are followed, that somehow that's control. But most of the day-to-day, like I said, is really happening at the local level. So some of it, I think, is just the idea that we don't want people, we don't want the federal government involved at all. I would argue that part of the role of the federal government is to protect those that are most vulnerable, and that's what most of those programs are there to do.
All right. Well, much more to watch for in the days ahead, but that's all the time that we have for right now. Kirabo Jackson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And up next, how a first-generation college student graduated from being a sales associate to a pharmacist. Stay with us. What began as a high school job led a first-generation college student on the path to becoming a pharmacist. Reporter Joanna Hernandez recently visited the city's Belmont Cragen neighborhood to share his journey. Here's another look.
At just 26 years old...
Hey, guys. What's up?
Freddie Gomez is a pharmacy manager at his local Walgreens on the northwest side.
But if you go to the pharmacy, typically you don't expect a kid like me in a white coat.
With a lighthearted smile, Gomez works at a pharmacy in Belmont Cragen that serves a large Latino population.
I love giving back, and the thing is, us pharmacists, we're the most accessible healthcare provider in the community. So, for example, in this neighborhood, a lot of uninsured, underinsured patients. So if they have anything going on, they're going to come to me first to avoid the cost or the troubles of going to a hospital without having insurance, because it's scary for them.
Born and raised in Chicago, Gomez began working at his local Walgreens as a customer sales associate during high school. After graduating, he began exploring potential paths for his future career.
My memory got triggered. Like, Freddie, remember when you were a little boy and you went to the pharmacy with your mom and you had to translate because the pharmacist didn't know Spanish? So, like, you know what? I could do this.
Through a tuition assistance program from Walgreens, students can receive financial aid to pursue a career in pharmacy. Gomez says he benefited from scholarships that helped him achieve his doctorate from Roosevelt University.
At graduation, they call your name, you cross the stage, Dr. Freddie Gomez, oh, mi hijo doctor. I'm like, yeah.
Like, are you proud of yourself?
I am.
But sometimes I'm still in disbelief.
Now Gomez says he hopes to inspire other young Latinos to pursue careers as pharmacists.
In the pharmacy profession, there's not a lot of us Hispanic pharmacists, Mexican pharmacists, but it's important for us to be here because it's not just because we speak the same language, we share the same values, we understand the same struggles, same culture, and that connection makes the trust more there.
The son of immigrant parents, Gomez says he proudly gives back to the community that shaped him, using his bilingual skills to serve others and stand as a bridge between cultures.
You're young, you're Latino, you're not like everyone else, you're going to have to prove yourself. And I'm like, just be natural, just do what you got to do. And all I did was show up, take care of my patients, take care of the community.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Joanna Hernandez.
And Gomez now mentors other aspiring pharmacists through Roosevelt's pharmacy program. We're back to wrap things up right after this.
Reflecting the people and perspectives that make up our communities, this story is part of Chicago Tonight, Latino Voices.
And that's our show for this Thursday night. Stay connected with our reporters and what they're working on by following us on Instagram at WTTW Chicago. You can also follow us on Blue Sky at WTTW. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 11:30 for the Week in Review. Now for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Nick Blumberg. Thank you for watching, stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that gives back to its community in Chicago and beyond.